This is The Guardian.
Election time, how do you feel about that?
Dread.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Dread.
Hi TikTok, sorry to be breaking into your usual politics-free feed, but I'm making a big announcement today and I've been told that a lot of you already have some views on it. So, first thing, no, I'm not sending everyone off to join the army.
Of the Liberal Democrats, of course, on a paddleboard and in the water. Apparently he fell in 5 times.
Why is Naz Shah, the Labour MP for Bradford, doing a big message, a big shout-out to her voters yesterday in a foreign language?
I think it's more important to stand in front of the electorate and say, I'm sorry, I can't now afford what I said before.
I'm Pippa Carrera.
And I'm Kieran Stacey.
You're listening to Politics Weekly Westminster for The Guardian.
Pippa, I want to start with an apology, bit of a mea culpa. When we sat here last Wednesday, I said that I thought the row over Diane Abbott, the Labour MP for Hackney North and Stoke Newington, would blow over in a day or two and we wouldn't be talking about it this time this week. But we are.
We are. I mean, I think the Labour Party would be delighted if we weren't talking about it. But obviously, we saw days of uncertainty about what was going to happen around Diane Abbott's fate until Keir Starmer said, finally, something with a bit of prodding from Angela Rayner as deputy, that she could stand. There had originally obviously been this deal, this expectation that she would be given the Labour whip back and that she would have the space to retire with dignity from her Hackney seat and not stand at the election. But I think what all this row has done has sort of stirred things up, and she seems to be so far more determined than ever to run again for Labour, and it's just not going away. I mean, yesterday we did a rapidly deleted tweet from her, didn't we?
Yeah. Not only is she determined to run for Labour, she also appears determined to make trouble for Labour as she does so. There was a tweet that started doing the rounds, and at first nobody was sure whether it was actually genuine, but it does appear to have been genuine. Very rapidly deleted. It was Diane Abbott retweeting a piece in the Observer, which quoted Keir Starmer as saying, "I have more respect for Diane than possibly she even realises," which was a kind of strange way to phrase it, I think. Anyway, she retweeted it with the comment, I think
More lies from Starmer. Which is the sort of thing that if any candidate said about their party leader, potentially could be a, you know, disqualification, deselection issue, particularly this close to an election. But it doesn't feel like Labour will want to make, after everything over the last few days, that they will want once again to change their minds on it and to bar her at the NEC meeting tomorrow. The NEC is the ruling National Executive Committee of the Labour Party, where the leadership, where representatives from the MPs, the unions, all the other groups, constituency parties, all come together and they make the rules and they make the decisions on things like who gets selected and crucially who doesn't. And that meeting is on Tuesday. And we're all expecting Diane Abbott's selection now just to sail through. Whether this latest tweet causes more problems, we'll have to wait and see. But I was out on Saturday at the launch of the Labour Battle Bus, which Angela Rayner is taking around the country, around all the battleground seats. She's very excited about it. She's basically saying she's got a fridge. I think there was
She's got a fridge, but she's got some milk and a lettuce with some googly eyes.
And what's that a reference to?
She's got her Liz Truss ready to go. I think she'll be bringing that out at pretty much every marginal constituency.
How long will it stay fresh for, though, I think will be the question.
Well, they should take it out of the fridge then, shouldn't they?
Yes,
they should have
that's
it rot
true.
During
that's
the
true.
Campaign.
It probably lasts to election day on July the 4th at this rate. But I was at that launch and I was talking to, obviously, Keir Starmer was there, Angela Rayner was there, and Rachel Reeves was there, lots of other Labour people too. I was chatting to them before they headed off on their road trip, and I think they felt that they'd reached a point where actually they could draw a line under not just the Diane Abbott row, but the sort of selection row more generally that they've had. That they felt that it would be that Starmer had said his piece, and in fact, when he was asked by the media for his latest thoughts on it, he said, "Look, I've already answered that. He was clearly wanting to move on and focus on other things." There was a lot of sort of energy and excitement around the bus launch. There'd been that defection the day before, which Starmer referenced in a joke. He said, "It's standing in front of the bus." He said, "It's almost like Tory defectors. You wait for ages, and then three come along in a row." Q groans from the. No, I'm sure there was a bit of laughter from the assembled audience. I think the one concern they still have over this election stuff is that the party has made a huge, put a huge amount of effort into persuading the public that it has changed. And that doesn't just mean in their offer to voters, but also changed internally from the infighting, from the Corbyn era. It's obviously further towards the centre than it was. And both to look like they are once again dealing in sort of internal warfare rather than concentrating on voters' priorities, particularly when Starmer has made a virtue of pointing at Rishi Sunak and saying, you want more chaos and division? You vote for this lot. We're a changed Labour Party. I mean, I think that's potentially problematic for them. So that's why I think they'll just want to get this elections meeting out of the way and to be able to focus on, you know, the outward-looking stuff and what their offer would be for the public.
So you were doing battle bus duties over the weekend. I was up in Sheffield for the inaugural Crossed Wires podcast festival, and I was representing this podcast and interviewing two Labour heavyweights on stage, live on stage. One was Oliver Cowper, the mayor of South Yorkshire, and the other was Louise Haig, who is a Labour candidate, I should say, no longer MP, because we're in that part of the campaign, for Sheffield Healey. And she's, of course, Shadow Transport Secretary, so she's part of the Shadow Cabinet. Louise is someone from the left, but she has also been very loyal to Keir Starmer and, you know, is one of those people who has survived the change into the Starmer administration. But she was clearly upset by the treatment of Diane Abbott. I think she felt very strongly about it, and this is what she told me.
I agree with Angela Rayner entirely. I think the way that Diane has been treated is shoddy, and that briefing against her in particular was really, really disrespectful. I think a lot of times in our politics, both internally in the Labour Party, but more widely at large, is so often lost, is that respect for each other as people. People get blinded by internal party warfare or external party warfare, and we forget that we're dealing with human beings and people's livelihoods and people's lives, and Diane should be respected as an absolute. It keeps on being said, and I don't mean it to sound condescending, but she truly is a trailblazer.
And it wasn't just Diane Abbott that Louise mentioned. We talked about Faiza Shaheen, the candidate in Chingford, who had been the candidate last time, was expecting to be the candidate again this time, and was removed very close to the deadline and unexpectedly. Louise also said that she had concerns about how she'd been treated, which, by the way, isn't the official Labour line.
I did see her interview on Newsnight, and you couldn't help but be moved by that. It was clearly very upsetting, and she was very upset. And when you've worked as hard as she undoubtedly has on that campaign and built a campaign around it, to find out in those circumstances is obviously deeply upsetting. And I think, you know, we and people across the party and in every political party need to really, really bear that in mind, especially in circumstances like that when she's a new mother.
I felt that was quite a strong statement. And I think that Louise Haig is not alone in the Labour Party in thinking that in this battle to reclaim Labour, the parliamentary Labour Party, from the Corbynites, there's just been a bit of that humanity lost here.
Yeah.
And people have kind of forgotten that you're all supposed to be colleagues
at
the end of the day.
I was speaking to a senior Labour politician yesterday who was saying to me, look, if the polls are right and we end up winning a not insubstantial majority, then we can afford to genuinely be a broad church and not say, just say it, actually mean it, and have people like Faiza Shaheen and Diane Abbott in the party that reflect a range of views. Now, all of that, of course, is not the way Labour HQ sees it. They say these are disciplinary matters, in Faiza Shaheen's case, and obviously when any disciplinary matter is launched and someone's suspended, that means they can't be the candidate. So it's about disciplinary matters and timing rather than factionalism. But we all know how it looks, right?
Yeah, so Faiza Shaheen, we should say, was removed after what the party said were problems with her social media activity. Retweets and likes of things that are not official Labour Party policy. And that's why she was apparently removed as a candidate.
Yeah, and all of this, I mean, I think the party would be pleased to get beyond the NEC meeting tomorrow because they really want to focus on the issues that will win or lose them the election rather than internal stuff. And we've got Keir Starmer out today with John Healey, the Shadow Defence Secretary, up in the Northwest, talking about Labour's commitment to defence and the nuclear deterrent, obviously within the Labour movement, has been quite controversial over the years. I mean, David Lammy, the Shadow Foreign Secretary even, not that he was Shadow Foreign Secretary then, in the last vote on the nuclear deterrent, I think it was 2016, voted against it. People in the Labour movement generally are not very comfortable about the nuclear deterrent, but Keir Starmer has made it clear that he would be prepared to press the button if he needed to, that he would take any action that was necessary to keep the country safe. This is like the whole, we talked about this before, Kieran, but the whole Labour strategy to reassure people on security more broadly, national security is part of it, borders is part of it, and economic security is also part of it. This week, of course, is the 80th anniversary of D-Day, so we'll see both Keir Starmer and Rishi Sunak at official commemorations later in the week. Once again, you know, from Labour's perspective, politically not unhelpful, drawing a line under the fact that, you know, he takes these things very seriously, and that he wants to be involved in those sorts of remembrance and commemoration events. But there's also another moment later in the week, isn't there,
yeah,
for a bigger moment for Labour?
Friday, we've got the slightly obscurely titled Clause 5 meeting, which is basically where Labour gets together with the unions and agrees their manifesto. And that is a big moment in the campaign. And I think we should expect to see a manifesto not too long after that.
Well, I think we'll be trying to get our hands on it before, won't we? I can't promise our readers and listeners and everything, but we'll try our best.
Well, we've been promised, of course, a slim manifesto. But there are Labour people that I've been speaking to in the last couple of days who thinks there might be one or two surprises.
Yeah, I'm not sure there will be. I've spoken to people over the weekend who say, no, there's not going to be a new policy.
Well, there you
go. It's basically going to be fleshing out the policy which we've already had. Rishi Sunak says the Labour Party doesn't have a plan, but actually they've got this booklet that they published about a year ago, don't they? This five missions document, which is, I can't remember exactly how many pages, but, you know, it's not insubstantial chunk of policy there, and I'm told that it's going to be building on that. But maybe I was just told that so that I, you know, to put me off the scent, who knows?
I think that the thing with those missions documents, and I think I've now read every single one, is they are largely, and Labour always points to them as being, those are our policies, that's our plan. If you read them, they're not policies, they're not a plan, mostly. They are very, very good, very thorough breakdown of what's gone wrong in Britain in various areas. They're brilliant. They're actually brilliant pieces of journalism. They're really interesting, very good data behind them. And then there are a set of targets for what should change under a Labour government.
But not solutions or how
but,
they would do
but
it.
But the missing bit in the middle is often not there. Mm. And that is, I think, why people say they haven't got a plan and why they haven't got policy. They've got lots of targets. They've got lots of things they can identify have gone wrong, but they're not very good at saying how they will get to those targets and how they'll put it right.
And of course, there's another big campaign moment this week with the first head-to-head leadership debate between Rishi Sunak and Keir Starmer. And I think this is going to be really interesting. It's going to be an ITV debate in front of a studio audience with Juliet Etchingham, the presenter, sort of guiding it. We've seen quite a lot of Keir Starmer versus Rishi Sunak at PMQs, haven't we? Although obviously that's a different type of event. I think it's the first time that many voters will have seen Keir Starmer in particular. And I've been really struck by some of the research that has come out in the last couple of weeks. We do focus groups at The Guardian with More in Common, an organisation run by a guy called Luke Trill. And last week, Luke did a write-up of a focus group in Hitchin, which is sort of a seat that Labour should win if it wants to, a new seat that Labour should win if it wants to have a substantial majority. And what came across very strongly was that this group had, while they had strong opinions on Rishi Sunak, the Prime Minister, the opposite was true for Keir Starmer. For them, Starmer was a totally unknown quantity. And one of them, I'll just read out, one of those asked in the focus group to sum up the view said, a woman called Beth said, I don't know if I think he'll be a good prime minister. I don't really know enough. But they all agreed that he was more acceptable to them in their Middle England background than Jeremy Corbyn, and that the Labour seemed more united than the Tories. This is interesting, despite the Diane Abbott stuff. Mm. But he's an unknown quantity. He's a blank canvas. And to some extent, that works quite well for Labour, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think that's a good thing for Labour. That gives them a chance to define him in the next few weeks. And it means that, you know, they feel that they've got their policy and their arguments and everything set up, and now they can make the campaign a bit more about him and you know, introduce him afresh. I don't think that the debates are necessarily Keir Starmer's best format, if I'm being honest. I think he can be quite wooden. I think that he's stiff and he doesn't often land jokes.
Do you not
sometimes
like his three defectuously buses joke?
No, I didn't. I'm sorry, but
you would have been the one at the back going, whoa.
Well, the worst thing is when he tries to tell his jokes about how much he watches football. And, you know, it's just like, you don't have to do
but
it.
But he does watch football. I mean, he's authentic in that regard anyway, isn't he?
I just think he's not loose enough to really...
It's the lawyer in him.
It's the lawyer in him. And that's fine. Okay, that's fine. And he will be a bit stiff and a bit wooden on the debating stage. I think Rishi Sunak will broadly come across well. He's bouncy and confident and upbeat. But I think there is a huge risk there for him, because we've seen it multiple times in the past. Every so often, he says something which just lands really badly. And often it's because he's been confronted with somebody either showing an emotion about something or complaining that something's gone wrong. And his reaction is often, first of all, nervous laughter, which goes down very badly, and then an explanation as to why that person's maybe wrong and actually things are much better than they might seem, or they're about to get better, this government is doing good things, really. He's less good at just empathising and, you know, understanding what people are saying in the moment. Yeah. And I think that that could backfire.
Well, that's quite a big risk for them generally, isn't it? I mean, I was out knocking doors with a candidate at the weekend, and we came across one Tory voter, a lifelong Tory, who wasn't saying that they were going to vote for Labour, but was saying that they weren't going to vote for the Conservatives, so they were probably going to stay at home. And they were saying, they showed us some of the literature that they'd been receiving through the door from the Conservative Party, barely mentioned Rishi Sunak, I should say, but it was all about things are getting better. Look, inflation is down. It's all thanks to us. And this guy is like waving this leaflet and saying, "What? Sorry, what, getting better? I mean, inflation is baked in, high prices. I don't feel better off." My God, are they serious? Do they really think I'm better off? And was really quite miffed at the fact that they were claiming that things were getting better. So, you know, while the numbers might suggest we are, people aren't yet feeling that yet. And I think if Sunak, who of course is an incredibly wealthy individual, stands there and talks about cost of living, the biggest issue, as we know, the economy is the biggest issue on the doorstep right across the country, and somehow suggests that people should be feeling better off, and I think that will go down really badly.
Yeah. I mean, one thing I think you should say about both of these men, and you do see it at PMQs, is they are exceptionally good, both of them, at holding a complicated brief in their heads. They both have very good memory and an eye for detail and an understanding of complex arguments. And from what our colleague Rowena Mason says, on the campaign trail, Rishi Sunak has been regularly leaving the public sphere, the public space, whatever he's been doing, and huddling with his advisors in private for what he has been calling prep sessions. So he's obviously taking this very, very seriously and furiously preparing.
Yeah, well, I think they both are going to be spending a lot of time in the next 48 hours. We're told that Oliver Dowden, the Deputy Prime Minister, has been standing in for Keir Starmer in some of that.
He has done this year after year, hasn't he?
He's done it for so many leaders, David Cameron onwards. Yeah. And there's a guy called Tom Webb, who's Labour's policy director, who's been standing in as Rishi Sunak for Keir Starmer's debate prep. He also plays that role in the team that prepare Keir Starmer for PMQs. And they've all been doing quite a lot of prep. Labour people say that Starmer feels quite confident, quite prepared. They made an active decision, we're told, over the last few months to go to quite a lot of workplaces like offices and factories and stuff like that, and to do Q&As with staff, with workers. And we've seen actually the Prime Minister do this in the last couple of weeks on the campaign trail, because they're much more sort of similar format to that you'd expect to see in some of the debates, because we now know, of course, there's going to be a BBC head-to-head debate. There's going to be a leaders debate for the leaders of the four biggest UK parties. And then there's a sort of seven senior politicians debate, all being done by the BBC. And I should quickly add, of course, we've got the first Scottish debate tonight with STV, where at 9 o'clock, where First Minister John Swinney, the SNP leader, Scottish Labour leader Anna Sawar, Scottish Tory leader Douglas Ross, and Scottish Lib Dem leader Alex Cole-Hamilton will all be debating. And it's the first time that Swinney will be up against these other leaders. Scotland is going to play such an important part in this election, because it offers Labour the opportunity to go from two seats north of the border to potentially two dozen or more, which would massively ease their path to getting a majority across the whole UK. So that's going to be an interesting one to watch later tonight as well.
You'll know this better than I do. Do you think Scottish voters will be more interested in that debate or the debate between Rishi Sunak and Keir Starmer?
That's a good question. I mean, I think the reality is that Scottish voters are very experienced at working out which election matters. And this is a national UK election. This, in the eyes of many Scottish voters, is about having an opportunity to get rid of the Conservatives. And many of them will come to the conclusion that the best way to do that is to vote for the Labour Party, because it's a UK election. They might take a different decision in 2 years' time, of course, when it's the Scottish parliamentary elections. But we'll obviously be there on Tuesday night for the Rishi Sunak, Keir Starmer debate, and we'll all be watching it with great interest, seeing whether, as you say, Keir Starmer manages to start to paint some pictures on that blank canvas. Mm-hmm. Is he able to be empathetic enough? No doubt we'll hear a lot about his mum being a nurse. There's obviously this sort of idea in Westminster that when we as political journalists start to get like unbelievably bored about hearing something, we had it with Sadiq Khan and Sajid Javid's dads being bus drivers, yeah. We're likely to hear it now with Starmer and his mum being a nurse. Only then is it starting to public it, to penetrate the public consciousness. So I think we'll hear a lot about Starmer's background, which we think we know, but which the public obviously don't. So yeah, so tune in, it'll be interesting.
Well, and we are going to be publishing an extra episode first thing on Wednesday morning. You and I are going to watch the debate together.
We are.
Which I'm looking forward to.
A beer or two maybe, if we're allowed.
Let's see if that comes across in the recording afterwards.
Be very jolly, wouldn't we?
And yes, we will be discussing it straight after the debate, and we will be putting that up on Wednesday morning. So by the time you wake up, you will have our analysis of it.
So what we will definitely see in the debate tomorrow night, Kieran, is Rishi Sunak trying to create wedge issues, find wedge issues with Keir Starmer. And wedge issues are often quite controversial areas that they think they can capitalise on because they have a difference of approach from the Labour Party. So we've seen examples of that in recent weeks with migration. We've seen it this week with, again, with defence. And another area which we're seeing this week is trans rights. We've had Kemi Badenoch, the Equalities Minister, out on the morning round today talking about how the Conservative Party wants to clarify the Equalities Act to make it absolutely clear that sex, as in the sex that you are born in, is a protected characteristic. Now, actually, the law already makes it clear that there's a difference between sex and gender. And the suggestion that if the Conservatives have been in power for so long, they've had plenty of time to clarify the guidance on this. So my first question is like, well, why haven't they done this already? Probably because they would encounter problems not just within their own party, but also out with. And Badenoch went to great lengths to talk about how there's been a lot of misinterpretation about this and how they want to re-emphasise. But as I say, the law already makes it clear. And to me, this seems like a way of them saying, this is what we want to do compared with what the Labour Party and the SNP want to do. The SNP obviously had their policy of gender self-identification, and Labour wants to make it simpler for people to change gender legally, although there would still be a medical process involved and a doctor would need to give sign-off. So for me, this is actually culture wars.
I think there is some truth in that. I mean, the only caveat I would put on that is that there have been people on both sides of the debate who've recognised for a while that this guidance needs updating because it was unclear exactly what the protected characteristic is. You know, is it biological sex? Is it self-identification? Is it somewhere in the middle? The problem for me is not the idea of updating the guidance to try and give a bit more clarity as to what should qualify under equalities law and what shouldn't. It's the fact that they don't actually seem to have done the work in figuring out what should qualify and what shouldn't. So Kemi Badenoch was on the Today programme this morning and asked a very obvious question, which is, when you say that it's biological sex, does that include people who have had gender reassignment surgery and who have, you know, a gender reassignment certificate?
Which means they can, of course, apply for a new birth certificate.
Yeah. And to me, that's such an obvious question that it was stunning to listen to her just not be able to answer it and then start to talk about the idea that we're getting into trivialities or just a very small
because
number
she can't
of,
answer the question.
Because she can't answer the question.
But does that not make you think then that, does that not question you the motives about why they're doing this? Because it really makes me feel that if they had thought that this guidance was so important to clarify, that they could have done it some time ago and wonder why they didn't. And I think that's not least because there are people inside the Tory party that felt that this was being weaponised as an issue, albeit, as you say, there are legitimate reasons for looking at the guidance, but didn't feel comfortable with the fact that it was being used by particular figures on the right of the Conservative Party in quite a kind of populist way.
Yeah, it's also difficult legally. I mean, they could have waited longer as well. And to me, if anything, it seems a little rushed.
Now, just because we're in the middle of election campaign, Kieran, we don't stop thinking about and covering really important policy issues, do we? And today, The Guardian has led with your story about British social care agencies who've been accused of exploiting foreign workers and leaving some of those people on the breadline, struggling to pay off debts run up while they're trying to secure jobs that fail to materialise.
Yeah, well, look, when people have said in the wake of the post office scandal and the infected blood scandal, what other scandals are there that are out there happening in plain sight, I would point them in this direction. I've been talking to dozens of care workers who've come over. All of the people I spoke to came from India, but people have been also coming from sub-Saharan Africa in particular. And what has been happening is that they pay thousands of pounds, up to £20,000 in some cases, for their visas and to come over to the UK for what they think will be a steady job working either in a care home or for a care agency going to visit people in their homes. Then having paid the money, they see almost nothing of what they were promised. They get to this country and they find that if they have a job at all, it's only a few hours work a week and they're not getting paid enough, barely enough to live, let alone to start repaying their loans back at home. And if they want to then leave that employer and try and find proper work somewhere else, they're threatened with deportation. So there are people who are basically stuck in this country living very impoverished lives. They just wanted to come over to help, you know, staff our depleted care sector. And they're not even able to do that because there are clearly, you know, money is going missing somewhere along the way. And, you know, I was shocked speaking to some of these people. And I've spoken to the Royal College of Nursing and they're calling for a government investigation into this. So one of my jobs this week will be to find out whether any of the three main parties would promise to hold such a thing. I'm hopeful they might, because somebody needs to actually kickstart a proper inquiry into what's happened in the last few years. If we've basically been so desperate to get people in to staff our care sector that we've forgotten to pay attention to who's actually manipulating the system and for what ends.
Yeah, there'll be obviously more on that really important piece of journalism on our Guardian website. And of course, Kieran and I will be back on Wednesday morning. Well, we'll be back on Tuesday night after the debate. You can join us to find out whether I did manage to crack open those beers during the debate or not, or whether my fridge's contents are also restricted just to a limp lettuce. That's all from us. Please like and follow Politics Weekly UK to make sure you keep getting our episodes in your feed. John Harris is back on Thursday. This episode was produced by Frankie Toby, music by Axel Cocoutier, and the executive producer is Maz Ebtahaj. Bye.
Bye-bye.
This is The Guardian.